Street Smart Podcast, back again, this time with Richard Rodriguez. So, man, thank you so much for taking time to come meet me over here at Core Office Interiors. They're so great to let me use this space. I mean, they don't even charge me. All I have to do is some light cleaning here and there.
this is a great space. I would love to work here every day.
I know, right? When I come in, I'm like, oh, man, they have the coolest stuff. Anybody that's never been here, it's worth coming in and looking. It's a great place. But man, thank you so much for taking time and to bring your story to the podcast. So thank you.
Appreciate you asking.
So like we were talking about just before, before we got started, this is really just a conversation of who you are and how it is that you came to found multiple businesses and end up being a kid from El Paso that is now in Houston, Texas, doing what you do. So let's start there, man. Let's start with you're born and raised in El Paso, and let's just get going.
Sure. Yep. Born and raised. 99% of my family is still there. Pretty typical Hispanic family. Very tight knit. My brother lives next door to my parents still. My stepsisters live, within a mile of them.
Yeah.
Pretty typical. I was the oddball that left. I had no idea what I wanted to do, but I just knew that there was like a world that was bigger than that, and just kind of fell into everything.
That's awesome. You go to which high school in El Paso?
I went to Hanks.
El Paso Hanks, man. Yep. So when I lived in Midland, Texas, I reffed football for 16 years. Straight out of high school, I was 18 years old, I started reffing football. And El Paso Hanks would come to Midland, play Midland High or Midland Lee every once in a while.
Yeah.
They play Midland High.
Yeah.
They had a tough time fielding a team,
always.
It seemed like.
Yeah.
So great. So when you were growing up in El Paso, was that your first experience, entrepreneurship? Did your what did your parents do? Did they own businesses or did they work for people or what?
No. So, yeah, they worked for other people. Mm-hmm. My stepdad came into my life when I was in middle school. He was a welder and then became an inspector. My mom worked for the electric company and then she worked for the school district. As far as entrepreneurship, I didn't even – back at that time, I didn't even know what that word meant.
Right.
But looking back on it, my grandfather, he was a plumber, owned his own company, so very entrepreneurial in his own right. My uncle became a lobbyist. He's been a lobbyist in Austin for God knows how long.
Oh,
very,
wow.
Very successful. I remember I went to stay with him during a session, I think it was like sixth grade. And like I got to work as basically I was just like a gopher in the House and the Senate for a couple of weeks. But it was like, man, there's this whole other world
that's
out here. And ever since then, like I can't thank him enough for that because it really opened my eyes to bigger things.
I would imagine, El Paso is a big city, but it's also kind of off by itself. And so I would imagine it can feel like there's nothing else out there. So it's great that you were exposed to that kind of stuff. Midland's not really an island like El Paso is, but it very much is, hey, you're going to be in oil and gas.
Right.
And when I was able to, get out of Midland and I was very fortunate that, I always had people in my life that weren't always in oil and gas. And so it was kind of interesting to see, you can do other things. Right. And move on. So you graduate from El Paso Hanks.
Yep.
What year?
94.
Oh, same age, man. I graduated 94 as well. So you graduate El Paso Hanks. Did you go to college?
I did. Went to Austin. Went to UT for a while. Didn't graduate. Had some family issues. Left early to come back and help them. And it was always one of those. Okay, like I'm going to go back, and I only had maybe like a year left.
Yeah.
But started working. I started working at a wire company that made copper wire harnesses for automobiles. And within a year, I was running that plant, and then recruiter called, and I had an opportunity to go to, it was either Alabama, Wisconsin, or Houston, and this was in 99, and I came to Houston. It was my first oil and gas job,
mm-hmm.
and immediately felt my first downturn,
Welcome to the oil field. You're laid off.
Exactly. First of many. And then from there, it just kind of took off and started working and doing other things and kept growing. And then I went to work for NOV.
Okay.
I was at NOV for 8 years. Best experience. I was really lucky. I worked for a division called Downhole.
Okay.
Back then. I think when I joined, we were about a $200 million division. When I left, we were a $1.8 billion division.
Man.
And it was
a division. That's not even.
Exactly.
Like, there are companies out there, successful ones, that don't get to the B.
Right.
So, yeah, that's awesome.
And, Jeremy Thigpen, who's now CEO of Transocean, mm-hmm. was the group president. And I was lucky enough that he gave me a ton of opportunities. You know, I was in my mid to late 20s and, you know, I was running facilities in Canada and, you know, I opened a facility in Dubai and,
oh, wow.
You know, with all those acquisitions, at one point, I think I was responsible for 17 facilities around the world. We went through the downturn of,
probably 08.
08. Consolidated that down to 9 facilities. So, you know, during those 2 years, nobody liked to see me roll into their facility.
Right,
I was
right.
kind of like George Clooney in that Up in the Air movie. People are like, oh, great.
I haven't seen that movie. Now I have to. Now I have homework. I appreciate that. You know, what's interesting is NOV, really, that was their model, was growth by acquisition.
Yes.
And so they would go in and they would purchase, and that integration piece was, they had that down to an art, I think. Really, really done pretty well. What were you studying when you were at UT? What did you study there?
Started in engineering, found out very quickly that that was not the life for me, and then just moved to business.
What type of engineer?
I was going to be a mechanical engineer, and
yeah.
that was just way too much. Yeah, I thought about, you know, do I really want to do this for my entire life? Because I had no idea what I wanted to do.
You just knew engineer would be
a
skill set, and it would pay well. And then you got in there like, this is not it.
Yeah.
This is not it. What were you passionate about at that time in your life? From a profession standpoint, did you even have anything?
I didn't even have anything.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
I know. It's hard to think that way, right, when you're in your early 20s. People ask me, man, when did you know you want to be a safety guy? And I was like, I don't know that I know that now. You know, I just sort of am. And it's been a fantastic career, and I wouldn't not do it again. But, man, when I was in my early 20s, I wasn't thinking that way.
Oh, no, not at all.
Not at all.
Nope.
So now you're in Houston. You're working for NOV. We're 2008 time frame. How long are you with NOV?
8 years.
8 years. And so when did you leave there?
I left there in 2012. But yeah, it was a wonderful time. Got to travel all over the world, you know, be in different places, you know, Brazil, Dubai, the UK, Far East, you name it. And,
Anywhere NOV is, you get to go there.
Yeah. And like I said, I was very lucky that, I basically had free reign within, you know, I was running manufacturing supply chain and then, you know, one of the things at NOV that was great, it was very sort of anti-Schlumberger is, you know, Schlumberger buys you and, you know, within 3 months you have their logo and, like,
right.
you're kind of indoctrinated into that way as to where, you know, the CEO at the time, Pete Miller, just, he was like, I bought you, you were making money, keep making money.
Yeah, just keep doing that.
Keep doing that. And it was great, but then sort of from an integration standpoint from systems and technology and different things, it did make it kind of hard
because sure.
you had all these disparate systems. So
sure. And also from a culture standpoint, a lot of times those people would look at it and say, you know, well, I'm company X, I'm not NOV. And even though NOV owns us, I'm still company X.
Yeah.
And even with Schlumberger, because my wife worked for a company out in West Texas and we lived out there that was purchased by Schlumberger, and they got to keep their logo, but under it said a Schlumberger company.
Right.
So it, yeah, you're getting that name in there somewhere. For sure.
Yeah, and that was actually funny because we did a lot of acquisitions, but the last one, the biggest one, was that Grant Prideco acquisition. So from that, we ended up getting Reed Heikkilag, which was the drill bit portion of that business.
Yeah,
and you know, very sizable company, and that was definitely the one where there was a culture clash, and it was it became very political, and it was more about kind of keeping your job than doing your job, and it just wasn't fun anymore. And that's just when I decided, like, oh, it's time to do something else.
Right, right, yeah. I've seen that culture clash firsthand when I went to work for Neighbors Well Services in Midland. It used to be Pool Company, and you had a lot of people that were, you know, Pool Company guys that were now Neighbors guys. I mean, they wouldn't wear Neighbors uniforms. They wouldn't, and Neighbors was very strict about, like, hey, this is your Neighbors now.
Right.
And they just wouldn't wear the uniforms. They wouldn't wear the hats. They still called themselves Pool Company, and then – they were pretty much given an option, like do this or leave, kind of a thing. So it was an important piece. But all right, so 2012, you decide, man, this is just not for me anymore. NOV, you leave NOV, and then what?
Started consulting for a couple of private equity companies for their portfolio companies. And then one portfolio company in particular was based out of Fort Worth, and they needed more hands-on help. And so I took a full-time position there. It was called Probe Technologies. Mm-hmm. Moved up to Fort Worth. Lived there for...
Where'd you live in Fort Worth?
Downtown.
Downtown Fort Worth, yep. Man. And that was awesome. Before it was cool.
Yeah, that was before it was like right before it like blew up and got cool. But yeah, I loved living there.
So we lived in Keller for almost 10 years. Before we moved back here. So we moved from Midland to Tomball to Keller to here. So that's my path. But yeah, it's funny. You kind of follow in a similar trajectory, just you started a little further west than me.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've lived all over the place, and Fort Worth was one that I would definitely go back to.
Absolutely, man. It was so much fun there.
Yeah, people are great.
Yeah.
And it's just, yeah.
Yeah, not Dallas so much. But yeah. Yeah. Fort Worth, for sure.
Two very different worlds.
Oh, my gosh. Unbelievably different. And people say Dallas, Fort Worth. It's like, no, those are separate.
Exactly.
They're definitely separate. Definitely a different vibe in Fort Worth than Dallas, for sure.
Yeah, the 817.
Yeah, that's right. My area code on my phone is 817. Yours is Spring now because you sold out and got a phone here again. So it's interesting that you left NOV and you went into consulting. Did you go directly into consulting, or were you looking for another job and you were like, man, I just need something to kind of bridge the gap here, so I'm going to start talking about things I know about?
That's exactly what it was. I was looking for the next thing. And then, you know, as I was talking to people, they're like, hey, I need help with this, or hey, mm-hmm. can you help me with this? And then just kind of fell into that. That's how that really started.
Yeah. It's always interesting to see, especially downturns. You look on LinkedIn and it's, you know, unfortunate. You see guys that, like, my name's Justin Overstreet. So all of a sudden it'll be like, oh, JO Consulting Services opened up, you know, and it's like, oh, well, what happened there? And so it's always interesting, people's path to consulting. And a lot of times it's exactly that. It's just, man, my buddy asked me for help with this, and my other buddy asked me for help with this. And next thing you know, you're growing a pretty good business. You're making pretty good money. And so how long did you consult?
I mean, technically I'm still doing it now. Well, I mean, there's still a portion that I will consult for, you know, oil and gas businesses, you know, as far as their, again, manufacturing, supply chain, their technology, mm-hmm. Or a lot of them now, if they need, you know, assistance and, you know, hey, we want to get ready for sale, or like, what is it, you know, how do you get yourself ready for an acquisition?
Gotcha.
Or what do people look for? So still doing a lot of consulting with that. But yeah, I did that for about a year and a half before I decided to, you know, really just go full time into Probe.
Mm-hmm. So is that the name of it? Probe?
Yeah, Probe Technologies.
Nice.
And did that, got them ready. I actually had them with a couple of offers from people. One was from NOV. They decided it wasn't the right time. You know, I decided that that wasn't something that I was going to be there long term for. And I had been talking to, you know, I've been talking to friends. I'd been talking to an ex-boss of mine. And we had always wanted to do something, and, you know, the downturn was coming, and you could kind of see things, and we thought the time was right to, you know, potentially do something. And, you know, he and I got together, brought in a couple of other people, and then we ended up talking to a couple of private equity companies, and then we ended up getting backed by Warburg Pincus, and that's how we got the funding to start Rubicon Oilfield. That was 2015.
So now you're a founder.
Yes.
A co-founder.
Yep.
And you start Rubicon. And what did Rubicon do?
I mean, at the time when we started, we were five guys in an office, really with a whiteboard going, all right, what companies are we going to go after?
All right, now we have money, now what?
Yeah. I mean, we knew we wanted to be oilfield services.
Sure.
You know, there's always opportunity there.
What type of services?
It was going to be more of that downhole tools,
yep.
You know, to where we were more of that manufacturing and supply rather than actual services. We mm-hmm. did end up getting into some services. Just through some of the acquisitions, but we primarily wanted to stay on the manufacturing and supply side of the business.
So now you got your five guys, you're sitting around a whiteboard, you're mapping out what you want to do, and man, it was successful.
It was a very successful run. You know, very tumultuous in terms of just the amount of activity that we ended up doing.
Right. This is 2015, and that was a downturn. I mean, I got laid off in 2015.
Very big.
Yeah, and so that was a bad one. Like, it was
pretty
brutal.
It was, and just the, you know, from a buyer's perspective, you know, the value that you could get for companies was really high.
Sure.
And the, you know, prices fell fast. I remember we talked to one company, and our initial offer when we first talked to them was in the, you know, we'll call it like the $180 million range. By the time we ended up acquiring them, you know, it was about $80 million to do it.
So, wow.
I mean, that's how fast everything fell.
Yeah, it was a bad downturn, and it was a fast one too. And so, you go from five guys sitting around a whiteboard to, okay, we want to be in manufacturing supply of downhole tools, maybe some services, and then now you're doing $80 million acquisitions. So how does that journey happen?
Yeah, so, you know, Warburg is different in that they're not a traditional, you know, private equity company. What they do is they look for leadership teams.
Mm-hmm.
And then what they do is they, you know, if you get to that point where they say yes, they give you what they call a line of equity.
Okay.
And that's what you would be kind of authorized to spend up to, right?
Yep.
I think our initial line was like $325 million, mm-hmm. which is, I remember when they said yes, and we were talking, it's like, can you believe that somebody gave us $300 million to go spend? Like,
right.
What?
Who would ever do this? Good grief, man. I'm questioning their capabilities at this point. Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
So, you know, we had a couple of near misses, and then we finally closed on the first acquisition, was Tercel. And I remember the day we did it because it was Cinco de Mayo that we signed the paperwork.
Nice.
That was 2016. That was the first acquisition we did, and then it really took off. We did, you know, our three biggest ones were Tercel, Logan Oil Tools, and then Topco.
So was that always the plan when you guys started? Okay, we want to do, obviously, downhole tool, manufacturing supply, some services, whatever, but we are definitely going to be actively looking to acquire. Was that from jump, that's what we want to do?
Yes. That was the entire premise, was we wanted to build something to be competitive in that space to an NOV or somebody like that. We wanted to build it to scale. We wanted to be global. And we want it to be big enough to eventually, you know, take public was always our goal.
Or get bought by NOV.
Exactly.
Either way. Yeah.
Either way works.
Either way is going to be a good payday. And so you use that NOV model of growth by acquisition to say, okay, we want to strategically push into these areas and pick up these business lines. And 2015, like you said, is a good time to do that because you can pick them up for, less of a valuation than what they probably should be going for.
Right.
Because it's kind of a fire sale in that moment.
Exactly.
And so, man, you kind of hit the sweet spot there in terms of being able to pick up that equity funding and go out and do this stuff. And in a lot of ways, I'm sure the people that you were acquiring were like, oh, thank you. Because, you know, it helped give them some breathing room too. Did you experience that?
And some of them, yes. Mm-hmm. Some of them, yes. Some of them, you know, you were dealing with teams of other founders in some cases.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's always, you know, now, you know, being, you know, a couple time founder and ex-founder, you know, it's a hard thing when you're not ready to, you know, that becomes your baby.
Right.
Like, especially for me, like, I don't have kids. Like, Rubicon was like my number one baby.
Right.
You know, Bits is now my baby. And, you know, if you're not ready to let that go, and it's really not on the trajectory that you kind of planned on, or circumstances dictate that, you know, you're not going to be a part of that anymore, it's tough. And so, yeah, we dealt with that. You know, some people were like, yes, thank you for coming in, and we're looking forward to it. And some founders we had, you know, it was tough. It was tough to deal with.
Did you as a founder yourself at that time go into the acquisitions that were a little tougher and think, man, I've got to learn some lessons here? And did you pay attention to that and kind of store that for, man, if my time comes like this, I need to respond a certain way? Did you look at it that way?
It was more so I had dealt with that You know, Probe was built by acquisition as well. And all of the original founders of those companies were still part of that company. And so, yeah, I mean, I had experience through there to see how they got treated while they were still working for the company. And then, you know, when a couple of them left, to see how they got treated, how their exits were treated. And that was a huge thing for me.
In what way? I mean, their exits were poor?
Yeah.
Okay.
Definitely.
On their end or on the purchasing company's end?
You know, everybody's got their own story to it. Yeah, like, sure, there's always two sides, and then what actually happens. You know, I think from both perspectives, and it gave me a unique perspective because I did have relationships with those founders, and I still talk to them today. We're still good friends. So I definitely got to see both sides of the coin as far as, you know, why did the company act this way, or why did they do these certain things, and then why did the founder feel this way, or,
right,
you know, what were things that he thought were going to happen that didn't end up happening, or things like that. So it was a unique position to be in, for sure.
Sure. And to your point too, in 2015 timeframe, these companies are being acquired because they have to be acquired, not because the guy's like, yay, I've made it, now we're going to sell.
Right.
It's they have to be acquired. So yep. the nature of my original question was, I'm sure in some cases those founders were like, I'm so glad to be out of that because it was just probably absolutely destroying them.
Oh, it's tough. Like,
yeah.
It is.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, when you're, you know, and I've done it both ways now, you know, when you have a lot of money behind you, there's, you know, it's got its own headaches and pressures.
Sure.
You've got these investors and, you know, you got to pay back this money and
expectations and everything else. Yeah.
And there's all of that. But when you're a founder on your own and you're bootstrapping it and you're just, you know, you're praying for that commission check to come in or for that contract to get signed. And you're literally looking at like, oh, okay, can I pay my rent this month? Like, I really need this to come in.
Right.
That's a whole different stress level.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So, yeah, there were definitely some of those guys that were like, thank you. Like, you get
to
take that weight off me. And then there were some that, you know, even though they knew it was the right thing to do and they had to do it, it's, you know, still hurtful to them.
With someone taking their baby away.
For sure.
And there's no level of courteous that you can go to as the buyer to ease that for them.
No.
And that's obvious, right?
Right.
So you guys are, you're going through, you're acquiring companies, and how long did you guys go with that?
Oh, I mean, it went until, so I left the company at the end of 2019.
Okay.
So it was right before the pandemic. Which was funny because I had these travel plans and I was going to like take a few months off and like I had some other plans afterwards of,
what
I was going to go do. And
joke's on you.
Exactly.
Not happening.
Exactly. but no, that continued to go through. And then Innovex acquired Rubicon, I guess it was about a year and a half ago now.
Okay.
So yeah, I mean, I still have investment in there and I want them to do well. And
of course.
Yep. So, yeah, they're still going, just under a different name.
Right. So left on good terms, getting ready to travel the world, have a good time. COVID happens. Then what'd you do? Now you're not working.
Yeah.
You're probably doing some consulting stuff just because of you still probably always maintain that, like you said, on some level. But, man, you were saying, man, I'm getting ready to take some extended vacation that I probably much needed. And now, oh, guess what? You can't do that. At least you're in Texas where it didn't just completely shut down.
Right.
But it certainly was different.
It was very different. And I guess, you know, one of the harder things for me is that was the first time I had ever kind of stopped, right?
Yeah.
And it was kind of a forced stop. You know, but all of a sudden, like, I had all this time and... Also, I didn't realize at the time how much of my identity was really wrapped up in work.
Yeah.
Like I said, you know, I was married, got divorced. We didn't have kids. So yeah, when all of a sudden, you know, now I don't have work to go with, and it was a huge thing to deal with. Like it was a hard thing.
Yeah, I experienced that when I transitioned out of the tech company I was talking about. It's like you're so plugged into everything going on day to day. And then all of a sudden tomorrow you don't have any emails.
Exactly.
Your phone doesn't buzz. Your phone doesn't ring. There's nothing going on. And then I wasn't locked down. So I can't imagine what it would be like to have that go from, you know, 100 back to zero.
Oh, it was literally, I tell people
and
all
then,
the time.
And then,
was,
you can't go anywhere and could do anything.
Yeah, so, it was, and I lived on a plane for those almost 5 years of
Rubicon. Sure,
you know, between, you know, because we have facilities all around the world and doing, I mean, I was nonstop. My calendar was always full. And, yeah, all of a sudden it was like 1,000 miles an hour to like hitting a brick wall and just being like, all right, like you wake up in the morning, you're like, well, what am I going to do today? And you're right, like phone's not ringing, emails aren't coming, you're just like,
and it's not like you can just go, well, I guess I'll go to the mall or I'll go out and eat or
exactly.
I'll go to the movies. You're not going anywhere. Nothing's going on. Yeah.
So no, it was difficult. And then, you know, and I knew in the back of my mind that I had wanted to start, you know, bits for a while. You know, I had been on the side of the table of, you know, buying technologies and seeing all these deals and, you know, having been involved in that. From that side, and I saw the opportunities that were there, so I knew I had, you know, I knew I wanted to start it, and then I just, you know, at some point, kind of, you know, you wake up and you're just like, all right, like, time to shake all that off and let's go on to the next thing. So, yep, started up and focused on bits, and you know, it's been really good. You know, the hardest part originally was, you know, after 23 years of oil and gas, mm-hmm. people see my name come up on their phone and it's like, oh, we're going to talk about oil and gas. We're going to do
this.
And, you know, really, it took a good year and a half to, I'll still talk about that with people, but like, you know, out of a 45 minute conversation, you know, I need 30 minutes of it to be on your tech stuff.
That's
and
right.
Like, what are we doing? And 15 minutes can be on oil and gas.
Okay, we get it. I know oil and gas. Can we talk about this other thing now?
But getting people to really think about, okay, when I have those types of projects, oh, now I need to call Richard rather than, oh, hey, I just need, like, advice on this oil and gas thing, or I need to bring him in on this project, which I'll still do, and I'm happy to do it.
Sure.
But trying to grow this other thing, so...
Before we get into bits and kind of what that is and everything, I want to go back to something you said, where you said that you realized through COVID that your identity had been wrapped up in your professional life.
Yep.
And that's easy to do. I think as men, we're absolutely susceptible to that. I know I am. And what are you, how do you think it got to that point? And then what are you doing now to safeguard against that? And I have my own ideas about how it gets to that point.
Sure.
Like for me, it's very much like, I can convince myself that I'm doing it for my family, or I'm doing it for, you know, I'm doing this for other people, when really what's happening is I'm doing it for me.
Right.
And I'm just talking myself into it. But I'd be interested to hear kind of what your thoughts are on how that occurs, and then how you're safeguarding against that now as a multiple time founder.
Yeah. I think, you know, I mean, everybody has an ego, right? Every person in the world has an ego. And when you're doing deals and you're doing all this great stuff and people are wanting to talk to you,
right.
And it's easy to get caught up in that. And again, it becomes your day to day, right? Like your mm-hmm. calendar ends up being dominated by work. And you know, most of the people that you hang out with are work related.
Right.
A lot of friendships are created, people that you think are your friends
come
from work. And then you find out, you know, when you're not there to really help them out or give them something, all of a sudden, like, they're gone.
Well, they can talk to somebody else.
Exactly. Exactly. And those are the things that I don't think you realize it as it's happening. I think it just sort of happens over time because,
sure.
especially now, because there is no kind of hard stop that people have between work and their life. Ever since these phones came, I mean, people call you and they email and they do all this stuff and it's true too that, you know, to have a successful business or to be successful, you do end up building those relationships, and the best relationships, they end up blending so I think it just happens naturally. As far as safeguarding it, I try to do a better job with it. I'm not always successful at it, but I definitely am cognizant of, taking more time for myself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I played rugby for a long time, and that's a huge time commitment. And I stepped away from a lot of that with Rubicon, just because it is such a time commitment in that kind of a team sport. But really, it's you know, being mindful of taking time for myself, making sure that I have my own activities, whether it's CrossFit or playing golf or whatever. You know, making sure that I have something on the calendar to look forward to, like a trip or something, you know, having some goal that's out there that's not work-related.
Sure.
Because your goals can easily get wrapped up into work.
Right? Yeah, they can only be work-related if you're not careful. I know for me, it's that way for sure.
Yeah, so being mindful of that. And it's tough, right? Because, again, like in this one, I don't have other, you know, I don't have other co-founders to lean on.
Right.
So if I'm not out there chasing business and getting contracts signed, the business isn't growing. So, but it's gotten to the point now where, you know, things have taken off and, you know, we'll be able to, you know, to bring some staff on here, you know, shortly. And that's going to give me more time, but really just being mindful of that and, keeping it in time to say, like, all right, like, I have to cut this off and I have to do this or do that or, you know, have things planned out. Right?
Yeah. Even being cognizant of it, though, it's so easy to fall into it. Like, we're sitting here right now and my phone's in my back pocket and it's buzzed so many times.
Right.
And it's not something that I'm dwelling on, but there's a level of stress in the back of my mind, like, I wonder what that's about, you know, that kind of thing. And so it's easy to fall into those traps. And I think it's great. I think that's exactly right, is you've got to have something not work-related that you're working towards. Like for me, I train jiu-jitsu 4 days a week. So I know in those times, I'm at least going to be away thinking about only making sure that guy doesn't choke me unconscious or whatever, right? And so it's very important, I think, to have that. But, man, it's an easy trap to fall into, and especially like you're talking about now with Bits, where you don't have other co-founders to lean on to kind of, hey, man, I'm going to dip out for a minute. Can you pick up the slack or whatever? Now I imagine there's a sense of urgency around any time the phone rings or an email to respond drop everything to do that, right?
For sure. Plus, too, I think you mentioned it, you know, as men, you know, we're not wired to you know, to kind of talk about that stuff, right? So if you are struggling with things, so I think you know, finding a person or two that you can, you know, to talk about that stuff with, for me, is extremely difficult, because I always feel like I'm burdening somebody.
Sure.
And that's a huge thing too. If you can, you know, find somebody, you know, go have dinner and like, hey man, this is what's going on.
Hey man, I'm dealing with some things.
Right, because like you think about it, you know, 9 times out of 10, if you go out, the first thing is like, hey, how's work going? And everybody's fine to talk about work. And
how's work? What do you do?
How's your family?
Yeah.
You know, those are the easy things to fall into, and they take up the hour of the lunch or the dinner, and like nobody ever asks, like, you know, how are you doing? You doing all right?
I would imagine the vast majority of successful men have a group of men in their lives that they can talk about things that only other guys will understand. And yeah, my wife and I have a fantastic marriage. We've been married, this will be 18 coming up, and we've been together, you know, 20 years or more. And, you know, I share everything with her, but there's just some perspectives that she's not going to understand, I wouldn't understand her perspective as a woman on some things. And you're right. Having other men in your life that you can, you know, kind of unload that on is critical. All right. So now we dip out, COVID hits. Oh my God, this sucks real, real bad for everybody. But yeah, internally, this is awful. But now you start Bits. And Bits is a departure from the things that you've been doing.
Right.
Right? And is this something that kind of starts as a passion project? Or is it something that you're like years ago thought, man, I want to do this? And if so, when did you first start thinking about doing that? First of all, what's Bits do?
So I would say
it's an acronym, right?
Yeah. So it's Business Intelligence Technology Systems.
Nice.
So, you know, what we do is we
also, if you want to break from oil and gas, probably name it something other than Bits.
Right.
I'm just saying.
Good point. Yeah.
Just an observation, you know, casual.
Good point. Yeah. I haven't thought about that. Good point.
Yeah. So anyway, it's a tech company, right?
Yeah.
And you guys do what?
So basically, think of us as you know, your trusted advisor for everything technology. So, communication systems, cybersecurity, you know, IoT, you know, a lot of things that you know, everybody needs. But there's so much tech out there, and there's so many options out there. you know, trying to wade through it yourself, one, is extremely time consuming, and two, you know, you need to make the right decision, because a lot of times it's a lot of money that you spend on this, right?
Right. And I've seen this too. Companies will invest the time and resources in either hardware or software. Yep. And then they'll try to force it to work, even though, oh shit, that wasn't the right solution.
Exactly.
In general. So
exactly. So, you know, think about me as, you know, if you have, you know, Wildcat Oil Tools and you guys were looking for, you know, a way that, you know, you could communicate, you know, internally and externally with your customers, but even internally with your own, because everybody's a customer internally of each other, right?
That's right.
Engineering, manufacturing, and you're looking for those, for ways to communicate better. Rather than you sitting through 15 presentations and waiting through all this stuff, you know, we sit down, I say, okay, what's important to you? Like, what are you looking for? Here. And then I bring you the top, you know, what's your budget?
Nice.
And then I bring you the top two solutions and say, okay, here's what I think fits exactly what you're looking for, fits in your wheelhouse of your budget. And now you have your two choices.
Right? Okay. So first of all, respect the fact that you sales pitched me on the podcast. It's awesome. I'll run it up the food chain. Second of all, that's a great concept, because I don't know how many times when I'm doing stuff, like just researching for this podcast, like I'll Google, you know, top 10 cameras for podcasting or, you know, whatever, and you get that list. And that's essentially what you're doing for your clientele, right? And so you're going back to your consulting roots, because yep, that's really what this is.
Exactly.
But you're consulting on, is it software or hardware or both?
Both.
Okay.
Both. So I'd say more on the hardware side. It's more on the IoT kind of thing.
Sure.
Because, you know, you're blending the sensors with the software, and there's so many options out there. So I'd say 80% of our business is on the software side, as far as advising.
Okay.
That's funny you say that about the sales, because I am a horrible salesperson. I am terrible.
I don't know, man. You worked it in smooth as butter into this thing.
I always ask people, like, what's frustrating you? Because as we were talking about earlier, people are always upset about IT. And I just laugh, because it's one of the things in business where, like, if you're not an accountant, you're not going to sit back at work and be like, God, why did he make that financial decision? I would never do
that's
that.
Right. That's right.
But you'll sit back on IT and be like, well, I connected my home network. I don't understand why we're doing this. This is terrible. Why is it so slow?
I set up my Ring doorbell. I obviously am a genius.
Exactly. Right.
Even though there's so much programming that goes into making it able for Joe Blow with an iPhone to set their camera up,
right,
it's unreal.
Yes.
But, you know, it's true. And, you know, IT sort of earned that a little bit in the beginning, too. I remember working for neighbors, and I tried to log into my email one time in my Outlook. I could not get it to open. It would open, and it would close. So I called the IT department here in Houston. I was in Midland at the time. So I called Houston IT, and I still remember the guy's name, because it was a funny name. But I'm not going to say it here, because, I mean, he's obviously going to listen to this. But he said, okay, well, I need you to log in and submit a work ticket. And I said, you need to hear what I said, right?
Right.
It's like, can't get into my email. He's like, you're gonna have to get into the system and submit a work ticket. I said, I can't. We went back and forth until he was like, oh, okay. Well, let me log in remotely then and fix it. And
right,
I'm like, are you serious? I'll send you the work ticket when it's fixed. I can't do that right now. So in some ways, IT's earned that.
For
just
sure.
Like safety has in past earned their spot, and HR's earned their spot, and operate. All of us have earned our
right
scars, correct? But you're attempting to solve that. You're attempting to take that sort of headache away and say, and I think you're smart to start the conversation too, like, where's your pain point? What are you most trying to solve with this sort of an application? And you're seeing some traction with that.
And, you know, and at the end of the day, I just like helping people, even if it's
right
a solution that I don't sell. And I, you know, if there's somebody I can refer them to, and, you know, I'm a big believer in karma. So, like,
yeah, absolutely.
You know, pass it on. You know, that's fine. As long as they get their problem solved, that's what I care about. I've always loved just helping people.
Yeah.
That just feels good to help somebody.
Let me tell you, man, in doing this, and I've interviewed a lot of people now, actually, and the it seems like the people that have had the greatest successes are the ones that just truly have a heart for people. Just really, man, I just really want to help. I just like they it's really kind of a servant mentality, right? And to your point, if it's a solution you sell, that's fantastic. That's what we're out for. If it's not, it still is a solution that you sell because you're selling the fact that you found the solution.
Right.
And when they're going to remember that, at least you hope so.
I hope so.
And if they don't, that's not on you either. You did the right thing, and that's the way it goes. And so you found Bits in 2020?
Yep.
I can't tell you how many people I've interviewed that founded businesses during COVID, dude. Yeah. It's crazy, man. Well, yeah, what else are you going to do?
Right.
And so you mentioned, too, you know, all these, I remember, I'm trying to think back exactly how you put it, but it was something along the lines of, you know, the, just sort of the disconnected nature of work now that we're always, you know, always on.
Always.
That's what it was. Yeah. We were always on. And I have a belief too, that the sheer number of people that are working from home now makes that problem way worse. Now, I personally like working from home because in my professional side, the HSE side of things, problems don't ever happen at like 10:30 on a Wednesday morning.
Right.
It's like 1 a.m, some dumb shit happened and you got to deal with it. So it's enabled me to be able to go up and have all of my stuff and my multiple screens and everything's right there without having to pack up and move it home every night. But I can imagine just the disconnected nature that people have now. Everyone probably feels like they have to be on even more.
Well, I think it depends on which business you're looking at, right? Oil and gas, we're used to that.
Well, yeah, we never stop.
Never stop.
Yeah, we never stop.
Right? But then you have people that never worked, you know, from home, that aren't used to, you know, picking up an email at, you know,
right,
10
right.
o'clock or whatever.
Right.
And to them, it was completely changed the world.
Right.
Like, well, you expect me to do this? Like, what? Yeah. It's 5:30. Like, but you're not in the office anymore. Like,
that's right.
It's just, you know, things change.
That's right. You expect me to believe that you work all day, every day at home. And at 5:30, you're like, well, I put in my 8.
Right.
So, I mean, it is true. And just the other day, I was actually on the phone at midnight on FaceTime with a guy out in Dubai or in Saudi, fixing a SharePoint problem that he had. And so you're right. Oil and gas, that's not something we're unaccustomed to, but a lot of people are.
Well, and, you know, it's funny. You read now that there's this, you know, people are trying to figure out, especially, you know, C-suite people, managers of, you know, are we going to, you know, back in the office, hybrid, you know, do I make it all, you know, work from home? And, you know, there's this, you know, there's these silos where, you know, traditional, you know, bosses are like, oh, there's no way that a person can be as productive at home if they weren't in the office. Then you have people at home that, and you have in everything, you have lazy people and you have responsible people, but the responsible people are like, no, I actually do get more work done because I can do things when I need to do it. Right.
Right. And I find my quality of life is actually better because I'm around my family. You know, I come downstairs for breakfast. Now I will tell you this, when I set up the office at home, I set it up in the media room upstairs and my wife was like, we have an office downstairs. And I was like, yeah, but y'all are down here.
Right.
So it'd be super distracting. So, but my point was twofold. One, I get up, I take a shower, I get dressed, I go up to my office. For me, there's still like some mental detachment. Like, okay, I went to work, right? These people that I can't imagine the feeling of just that you aren't at work if you were just balled up on the couch with a laptop doing whatever. I have to be, for me, I function best if I have a dedicated space, right? And I think you're right. I think some people function really well at a high level. It doesn't matter if they're in the office or at home or, you know, on vacation if you need them. Other people have to have the structure of an office in order to hold them accountable to, you know, a schedule.
Yep.
And I think that I think it's going to be hard for CEOs to pin down a one-size-fits-all. They're going to have to really try to understand their people. And if you have a huge company, good luck.
Right. Yeah, and I think that's there's not going to be a one-size-fits-all.
No.
Right? There never is.
I'm asked every time I'm in Midland by Duke Edwards if we need an office in Houston again. I'm like, no, I'm good, man. I literally get as much done now as I did when I was in an office just because it the nature of what I do, and it's interesting. And so what are you seeing right now in terms of solutions people are after that is outside of what you thought you would see?
Outside of what I thought I would see, it's again trying to it's this whole thing, this hybrid work thing, right? Yeah. Like, how can people stay connected on a screen, right?
Right.
And because, yes, you develop more relationships when you're in person than you do on a screen, but it's more so about how do I get the information that I need from that person if they're not in front of me? Because if you're getting a cup of coffee, you're going to hear something
sure.
from, I'm going to hear something from you that I don't get while we're on our Zoom meeting, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or you're going to think about an email that you sent me 2 weeks ago and it's going to trigger you.
Yeah,
you
oh, see hey, me by and, the way.
By the way, yeah. Exactly, right? So it's bridging the gap with tools that bring up those types of histories, that bring up those conversation histories. So when you are in a meeting with somebody on a Zoom, you have that entire, you know, sort of one pane of glass that shows you all that stuff. That's a big one. And then the number one thing we hear all the time now, cybersecurity. Security is, yeah. And people are always wondering, like, how can it be better? What can I do?
At least the good thing is that there aren't a lot of products out there, so it's very clear to the consumer what they need to use, right? They just put McAfee on and go on about your business.
You know, there are a ton of, there are a number of applications. There is no one size fits all, no matter what company comes and tells you that
sure.
there's not. You need to have the right partner that can kind of help you through that. But your number one issue, no matter, I don't care how much you spend, I don't care which tools you pick, your number one issue is always going to be people.
Oh, of course.
They are your biggest security risk. And but I think it's also a function, and I tell C-suite people this all the time, it's a function of how you treat security, right? Because in their personal lives, they're very protective of their phone, their bank account. They'll do two-factor out there. They'll do it all in their personal life because
sure.
it's personal to them. At work, the first thing you put up on your quarterly report is what? Your revenues,
mm-hmm.
you know, oil and gas, safety record,
yep.
your revenues,
right? Safety and P&L.
Security comes once a year when everybody, when your managers, your CEOs get up and they're like, I know this sucks, guys. It's once a year, but everybody's got to do this training. Yeah. Please get it done.
And do it at the same time you do your HIPAA training.
Right?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Same training.
So when it's treated like that, people are like, oh, it's a burden to me. They
sure,
don't take it seriously.
Sure.
Why should I take it seriously? You know, if you had it at the forefront of your quarterly report, you know, here's our safety, here's our revenues, here's how many safety.
Yeah,
you know,
here's how many breaches cyber, we had.
Here's
yeah.
how many attempts we had. Here's how many breaches we had. People start to think that, okay, this is important to us, right? And it's important to you, and I'm going to start to take it seriously.
You know, that's interesting. And when you say it that way, I wonder, it speaks to a larger issue, right? Like, people will place emphasis and value on things that you place emphasis and value on. And so if you're a leader of a company, how do you, like when you were leading your Rubicon, how did you decide what to focus on and report out? Did you have employees?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you had a ton, right? Acquisition, right? So how did you decide what to report out to those people? And did you think about it, like, what we're reporting is going to inherently communicate what's important to them, so I make sure I report these specific things? Or did you just say, this is the standard deck of things that you report?
No. So we definitely had, you know, we had our, you know, reports you do to the board, there's reports you do to, you know,
investors,
the executive staff, there's the management team. I would have a much different report that I gave to the manufacturing guys, right? It would still be about safety, it would still be about revenues, but it was tying, what does that mean to this specific plant,
right?
Like, you guys have this many hours, you know, we're now going to invest in these, you know, four new machines because this is what the business is doing, this is how it affects you, mm-hmm. right? So you have to, you have to have different levels of reporting for different audiences.
Did you, at the time though, when you were reporting that out, were you thinking about it in the context of what you were just saying, where you're like, if I communicate this, that means it's important to me, so I better communicate this? Or was it just like, hey, was it just something you knew to do?
No, something I learned over time.
I mean,
we saw it in oil and gas industry, right?
Right.
I mean, safety was terrible in the 70s.
Right.
And people were like, okay, you make it a focal point. And what do you do every meeting? Like, you go to Halliburton, you go to Schlumberger,
right.
you go, what's the first thing? We have a safety moment, right?
You know what's interesting, too, right. and you're right, that is exactly what happens. I do think, and again, this is not to get off on a safety tangent because that can happen easily here.
Sure.
I do think in the spirit of what gets communicated or emphasized is what people focus on, you can drive an improper behavior that way as well. So for a long time, and it still continues, not so much with majors as much now, but it does continue where the people look at that incident rate and they say, you do or do not get to work for us based on this number.
Right.
Right. What does that do? That forces companies to decide, okay, do I want to capture this number accurately and risk losing business, or do I not want to do that and keep the business? And I think they can drive a really poor behavior, similar to if you said, I'm going to financially incentivize you to be safe. Well, I'm also telling you, don't report things
exactly
to me, right?
For sure.
And I think that you have to be mindful of that. In anything that you're presenting or anything that you're telling people, this is important, you can drive an improper behavior unintentionally.
Oh, 100%. I mean, that was, you know, TRIR was a number one thing, but
sure,
then, you know, that was always a backwards looking metric. You needed to think, you know, how many incident cards are you filling out?
Right.
You know,
stop work authorities were used or whatever.
All those kinds of things. Right. So I think that,
but how many times do you see those metrics presented?
I mean, I can't speak to other people. I know we kept track of them at Rubicon, and we would present them internally, and we would present them
sure
extra. Our board was they were very mindful of safety, and they wanted to see how active the employees
were.
Yeah,
I mean, you do see it more now. I've been in safety over 20 years. I've come all the way from, hey, here are these videos to watch, and here are the answers to the test, to what we do now, which is, I mean,
oh, yeah,
it doesn't even look like that at all. So, right. But going back to one of the questions I had before, at what point did you realize that this gap in the tech market existed? And was it when you were still working for Rubicon and you were trying to assess your own systems? And you're like, man, I think there's something here. Or sooner than that or later than that? Or about when did you start realizing, man, I think there's something here if someone did this?
It probably crystallized with Rubicon.
Yeah.
You know, it had always been there even back in the NOV days, because as you're doing all these acquisitions and now you have 10 different ERP systems and it's deciding which one are we going to go with, you know, or are we going to go to one that we already have, or are we going to go to something completely different? Or, and then you just, you know, I've always had a passion for technology and I've always just been curious about it.
Mm-hmm.
So just, you know, trying to stay in front of things as far as how can, and again, it was always, everything we talked earlier was there's a huge gap that's missing between kind of IT people,
mm-hmm,
and business people, and getting them to communicate that. And, you know, like the tech people understand what these tools are and they understand the importance,
right,
of it, but they have a very hard time communicating how it impacts the business and how it can impact revenues or, you know, sales opportunities or things like that. And so just trying to be a bridge into that.
Yeah.
I was always a bridge to that before internally.
Sure.
And then just taking that and saying, okay, I want to be that bridge externally for people.
And sometimes those tech people, because they know exactly what it needs to do, they have a tough time tailoring their message. And it can be very rigid about,
yes,
no, you're wrong about that.
Yes.
And I've seen that failing in safety professionals as well. And it's something that I've always been mindful of as a safety professional, like, hey, man, my job isn't to make it harder for you. It's to explain why we have to do it or make it so you can.
Right.
And so this is kind of a slow burn then, Bits is, from NOV days,
oh, yeah,
through Rubicon. And then you finish Rubicon, hit COVID, and like, well, shit, now I'm just hanging out. And you're like, you know what? Let's try this thing out. And so you found Bits 2020.
Mm-hmm.
Again, there have been so many people I've interviewed that found it in 2020. It's actually quite funny. You know, like Josh was talking about, Josh Lowry, he was episode 3. He was talking about, you know, he kind of built a mini incubator during COVID. Were you a part of that?
I was not a part of that. I knew it was happening.
Yep.
I wish I had gone into it earlier.
Dude.
Because that's who, you know.
I wish I knew about it too. I'd have gone and hung out and gotten free food.
Yeah, exactly.
On Josh's dime. Thanks, Josh. Thanks for the invite, bud.
Yeah, but it's funny because now I office at the Upright Digital,
right,
office. I keep an office there. And so I see all the podcasts going on and, you know, talk to Josh all the time. And Yeah, I wish I had gone into it earlier, but yeah, that would have been amazing because so many, what, 3-4 companies birthed out of that office,
if not more, yeah. and if they haven't birthed now, they certainly ideas are out there for them. Just a brilliant idea, and he was right when he said there were other people sitting around during COVID going, this sucks. I want to go somewhere. And so he had a spot for them. That was cool. Again, thanks for the invite. I didn't get it. So whatever. Must got lost in the mail or whatever. But so you found Bits in 2020, and is just you, or is it you and just you, man?
Just me.
And so how do you get the word out? Like, as a founder in the beginning of the business, and you're like, man, I got this thing. And oh, by the way, the world shut down. And obviously you can tap into your existing contacts and those types of things, but how do you get the word out and explain, like, hey man, I'm up and running and this is what I want to do?
LinkedIn has been probably my number one
it's amazing
resource for that. And just, you know, again, I just take it from the education perspective of like, hey, this is coming out, like this law is coming out that's changing and it can affect your business, or hey, like this new technology's out, or hey, this is how this can affect your business. And it was that. I mean, you know, obviously launched a website,
right?
You know, those kinds of things. Working my network. It's kind of like, you know, and then as soon as, you know, luckily in Texas, you know, we were able to gather earlier than everybody else in some ways.
Yeah.
So just getting back out there, as soon as people started having networking events and, you know, and now it's back to normal, but like when they first started and, you know, so-and-so was having this event and where there used to be, you know, 50 or 60 people, there were four. Hey, I'll be one of the four.
Hey, why not?
Why not? And yeah, just being part of that again, because it was almost like everybody had to restart those networking functions again from scratch.
Well, you didn't get to work that muscle out.
Exactly.
And so you kind of, you had to relearn the moves a bit.
Right. And yeah. So, you know, if you're, you know, if whatever organization called and said, hey, we're going to have drinks or do whatever. Okay. Well, if I was one of the four and now we're back to 100 people, I got to see all those 100 people come in over the last year.
Oh, yeah.
That's just more exposure, right?
So. And really, so it's about, man, just putting yourself in the position to sort of be a gatekeeper through that. And LinkedIn's fantastic. We obviously Wildcat has a huge presence on LinkedIn, and it's been very interesting to listen to people talk about, you know, when I tell them, yeah, Wildcat, you know, got a couple hundred people that work for him, they're like, oh, I thought you guys were much bigger than that. I was like, of course you did. This is intentional.
Right.
And you know, we're not deceiving anyone, but it does feel like it's a much larger company. And, you know, one observation on LinkedIn I find funny is, you know, my LinkedIn picture is very buttoned down. It's black and white. It's got the suit. I'm facing just the right angle. You know, it's a headshot. And, but man, now that you're getting a younger workforce in there, you're starting to see people put pictures up that, up in the club, you know,
right.
Those kinds of pictures. It's like, I mean, this, come on guys, it's not Facebook or Instagram. Let's figure this out. It is certainly changing. And I find it interesting as a founder, I'd love to get your take on it. I was telling my wife, I was like, you know, the things that my dad would tell me when I was starting to get in the workforce was, you know, get in with a good company, you're loyal to them, they're loyal to you. Don't jump around, that looks bad on your resume. And then if you look at my resume, about every 5 years I'm moving around or doing something, or sometimes sooner than that. And I talked to him about it, and he was like, yeah, actually, that's different now. And so my point is, those things can change. And so as you get a younger workforce, that I would be like, tell my daughters, hey, don't post that online. It never goes away, you know, whatever. Once those people are our age and running departments, they're not going to give a shit that picture was posted online because they did that too. And so I find that very interesting, sort of that changeover. Where you didn't maybe get to see that before with social media, you almost get to see that in real time.
It's social media has changed the world completely. And I mean, if you talk to, I was reading a study the other day, you know, I still think privacy is a big thing, but if you talk to people under the age of 25, they don't care about their privacy because right. They've grown up in a world where they've been on social media pretty much their whole lives. And I mean, their life is an open book and they're like, well, whatever.
We grew up when there weren't even phones.
Can you imagine if you were a kid and you said, a stranger's going to come pick you up in their car, right? And you have to trust them to take you to some place without like kidnapping you. And they're going to know where you live, by the way.
Oh, now. Yeah, for sure. Or, hey, someone's going to pick your food up and deliver it to your house. And you're going to trust that that's going to be safe, you know, and it is. And it's weird. Not a chance. No, not a chance, man. It's amazing how much stuff has changed, and you hear, you know, I asked my grandmother one time what the number one invention in her lifetime has been, and her answer was a washing machine. And if you ask me, I would say the internet.
Yeah.
But she didn't give a shit about the internet. It was a washing machine made her life so much easier. And I think that those types of things are interesting things to look at. So now Bits is going, 2020 banner year, 100 million in revenue, or close, right? Yeah, no, but definitely some traction, right? You're starting to get some traction. Even how soon out of the gate did you start seeing some traction? Obviously, you have a sort of a built-in network that you can tap. But what did you see? What were some challenges initially in getting that traction? Other than COVID, because that's an obvious answer.
I would say, really learning about all the things that I thought I knew that I really didn't. So really immersing myself into learning a lot more about different technologies.
Mm-hmm.
Building that whole network within that group, right? Because I had an entire, private equity and oil and gas network, but I didn't really have a network of, tech professionals. I knew people.
Sure.
But I did not have it built out to that. So, making vendor relationships, because you know it's all about relationships, right? Having somebody you can call because things inevitably go wrong, and being able to call a person and say, hey, I'm having a problem with this installation, or your project manager is terrible and I need help.
That never happens. Come on, man. All project managers are great.
Building all those that's really what it was. I would say 2020 and even into last year was building knowledge, building that part of the network, getting to establish those relationships, educating my network on what I was doing so that they could start to think of me in that regard when those things came up. It was a lot of groundwork rather than creating revenue.
Right.
So luckily I had, a bit of a financial runway that I could, put that in. But
Because when you did Rubicon, they gave you $300 million and you already sort of knew what you're going to do and you had other people to help you do it. You literally are bootstrapping this thing from jump, right?
Yep.
So, that's a stressful thing.
Yep.
How do you identify that point where, hey, man, I can bring some staff on now? How do you know it's the right time to do that?
I think it's like anything else. I mean, there's numbers you can look at, but it's really more about feel than anything. Mm-hmm. For me, it's always been about, you just got to follow your instinct. You got to follow your gut. I mean, I haven't brought any direct employees, but right now I've probably got 21 contractors that work for me for different things. And that continues to grow depending on the project sizes that we deal with. But now it's to the point where my time is getting, it's getting to the point where I need help too. And we've also got a network of contractors and other people that we trust that we can take on more bandwidth. And so being able to bring more projects on and bring a salesperson or a business development person or two on, it's the right time.
Right.
Because what I didn't want to do was bring that part on, and then all of a sudden I'm saddled with 10 projects. I have nobody to work them. I'm trying to do it all myself, and then it fails, and then nobody ever trusts you again.
Right, and that's a unique perspective, because a lot of people might look at that and say, I don't want to saddle myself with the salary and the commission burdens and all of that, and or have them sitting around with nothing to do. You looked at it and said, well, if I hire them and they're hitters and they get us work, I wouldn't be able to do it anyway.
Right.
So that infrastructure has to be in place before you can even do that. So that's a look at it that I wouldn't necessarily have thought about. So that's great. But you say now, okay, it's all about feel and those types of things. What is the tipping point for you where you go like, okay, I feel like this is the thing. And it may not be a specific point in time, but is it when you start seeing, okay, I'm having to devote my time to these things that are taking away from my ability to do these other things? Or is it simply just man, if I had this, I know we could grow this much more.
It's, you know, I think it's a combination of things. I think it's having the relationships built, you know, with suppliers that I know I can count on. So I know that I can have the support that I need. So, I mean, I'm, you know, nobody knows everything, right? So I rely on like a lot of like cybersecurity. I know a lot about it, mm-hmm. but you know, when we get to the really technical stuff, I've got to be able to bring in, you know, a cybersecurity engineer to talk, you know, to a specific person within a company. You know I can't do that. But I have resources now that I can call on that mm-hmm. I trust that are going to, you know, give them the right information that they can make the right decision. So I say it's a combination of that. It's a combination of kind of the sales pipeline and the at-bats coming to where it's more than I can take. And so definitely needing somebody else mm-hmm. to be able to do those presentations besides me so that we can get more opportunities. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, market size is not an issue because, I mean, the market continues to grow for all these products.
Of course. Yeah, of course.
But I think it's too, it's again, fine, you know, our name is out there. People understand it. So we are getting those calls now where it's like, hey, I don't know what I need, but I know I need something. So, you know, can you help me out? And those are happening more and more. And so, again, it's just being able to field those at bats, right?
Sure. Sure. And you're right. You have to have staff to do that.
Yep.
And so that creates a whole different set of stresses and those types of things. And so how are you – I mean, obviously you've dealt with large staffs through the acquisition process and those types of things. This will be interesting because you bring people on straight into the company. So it's not like you bought another company that has these people. What are you going to do to ensure that they carry forward, you know, your vision – because that's what you're hiring them sure. to do.
So actually it's pretty funny. I learned a lot about that from Rubicon because, you know, even though we had, you know, people are like, oh yeah, you had all this money and you were buying this. Yes, we were buying companies, but you know, other than the three largest acquisitions we had, we were buying, you know, small companies mm-hmm. and we wanted to do things kind of a different way. So, you know, being an entrepreneur and bringing people into a small company that doesn't have resources, you have to find that right person. And I remember we had a number of people that we would hire at Rubicon that would come in from Schlumberger and all the big three or four. And I would always tell them, it's like, this is different. Like,
yeah,
you know, you don't have a staff to go and create like, oh, I want a new PowerPoint presentation for this product or that. It's like, you have to do
that.
Yeah,
you do that.
I, you know, you don't have a database like, I'll give you the resources to do it, but in terms of the data, but like, you're going to have to go create this yourself.
Right.
And people would always say the same thing. Oh, that's why I want to leave a big company. I want to be part of something yeah. that I can be from the ground up and I want to be right. able to create that. But then they get into it and they're like, well, where's this? And where's that? You're like, you have to go do it.
Go build that.
And they're like, oh, like you were serious. It's like,
yeah.
yes.
Yeah. Dead serious.
So I got a lot of experience in that, and I think that's going to help me with the people that I pick for bits because you have to have people that can do it themselves, that they really are, you know, they're self-motivated, you know, and they want to be able to do what it takes to kind of get that done.
So since you talked about business development, you're bringing those guys on, I'm just curious question because I've had people try to push me into business development. I've ended up in it a couple of times, and I always say by accident because I just, you know, there are some things about it that I find limiting for me personally. Like if there's a commission structure associated with it, those types of things, those, and it's going to sound odd to say, but those things are demotivating to me because I'm like, hey man, I'll kill myself because I'm just wired that way to win. Cause right. I like to win. I don't need you to incentivize that with some huge commission. Just pay me really well.
Right.
And I'll murder myself for this company. What are your thoughts on how you set up a payment structure for a salesperson or a business development person? Do you like the commission versus salary or vice versa?
I like I mean, I think it depends on the person. And I think that there's room for both. I don't ever like to set things up with like, you have to do it this way.
Right.
I think people are different. They have different skill sets and, you know, there might be people that are are great on salary, and you know they bring a book of business with them that,
right.
And you know they don't want to go chase more business to where a commission structure is really gonna incentivize right. them to go kill it that way. They want they're at a point in their life where they want something that's stable, that's safe, they can count on, but they're good hard workers, and like you're gonna get X out of them.
Right.
As to where you've got other people that, you know, money is the real driver for them, and they're going to go get you 50 new deals, and right. or they don't have a book of business, and they want it. The incentive of going out and making those big commissions with new clients is really motivating for them, and they're at this point in this life, and, okay, they don't want to just do X. They want to have the opportunity to do these other things. Yeah, let's go do that, right?
So, yeah, so there's room for both,
there's
right?
There's room for both.
I agree. And I have come across sales guys that are like, oh no, don't pay me a salary. Just make my commission so much that it doesn't matter. Right. And either I perform or I don't perform.
Right.
I always found it limiting when I was in business development because I enjoy, like we're doing right now, I enjoy a long form conversation where I can learn as much about what you're doing as possible. And if I've got to worry about, you know, closing that deal to turn my lights on tomorrow, I'm less inclined to spend hours learning you and learning your business. And right. so that's the reason I say it demotivates me because it puts a different stressor on me. So,
sure.
So Bits is moving on. You guys are doing good. And then what? Your idea is just to keep growing it and just do that until what? Until it's over.
I wouldn't say that it's over. I definitely have, you know, There's a lot of opportunity in this space as far as, you know, private equity has taken a notice to this part mm-hmm. of the industry. And, you know, there's consolidation and there's opportunities for things like that. You know, for me, yes, at some point I want to, you know, give this baby up. But I really enjoy what I'm doing and I want to just continue to grow it. And, you know, I want to bring on people that I like working with and that I have fun doing it with. And, yeah, I just want it, you know, but it's funny, Josh, we were talking a few weeks ago, and he really put it to me. I had never heard somebody ask it, but he's like, do you want Bits to be a lifestyle business or do you want it to be like a real business? I was like, what do you mean? He's like, well, like a lifestyle.
That's the most Josh yeah. question.
Exactly.
Yeah, what are you talking about, dude? None of that makes yeah, sense.
Right. He was like, well, you know, like a lifestyle business. He's like, it's great. It pays the bills. It does all that. He's like, but it allows you to take trips and like live a lifestyle that you
right.
want.
Right.
And he goes, and then like, as long as it provides for that lifestyle, like you're fine with that business the way it is. He's like, or do you want to grow it? And I was like, no. Again, I don't have kids. So again, like I look at, again, helping people. Like I love being able to give people opportunities.
Sure.
So that's what I really loved about Rubicon. I liked giving people opportunities, giving them opportunities to grow in their careers, to do things that they never thought they wanted to do.
Right.
And that's what I want with Bits. I want to grow it to where people can come in and they have opportunities to do things and learn new technologies and, you know, help people. And I want to continue to grow that to a point where it's like, okay, like I've done it, I've taken it as far as I can take it and let's sell this or do whatever we're going to do. But, you know, I want to be able, you know, when I'm on my deathbed to say, hey, there's I left a legacy
right,
with this. Right.
Right.
You know,
so you want a real company
for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I think it's great, man. And like I said, I really do appreciate you coming on and sharing your story with me. You know, starting in El Paso, El Paso is an interesting place and people can get stuck in El Paso.
Right.
And it's great that you had someone that took you to Austin to see that there's other things and other ways to do things. And then you end up in oil and gas anyway. So that's hilarious. It's funny. People, you know, oil and gas is such a villainized industry, but man, there's been nothing better for me and my family and for literally hundreds of millions of people and their families in the world throughout the years. And so it's an amazing industry and tech's that way too, man. And tech's one of those that's,
right.
It's only growing. It's not going to slow down. Security is going to be even more important. I can't tell you the number of times that, you know, my wife's card gets picked up cause she's online shopping or, you know, mine gets picked up because of whatever reason. And, you know, those things they're better at it now. Wells Fargo emails me directly and says, hey, this doesn't make sense from your spending patterns. Now I have other issues personally with, like, now you know my patterns too much, but I also am a pretty predictable person. So those things are important, and they're only going to keep growing, and I think you're well-positioned. How many other people are doing what you're doing? Are there? I'm sure there are other companies that do what you do. But
yeah, I have a lot of competitors. You know, but what I do like about this industry is, you know, even though they're competitors, I've developed a lot of relationships with them. Mm-hmm. They've been very helpful as far as talking to them about how they started. I would say majority, at least 85 to 90% of my competitors started in that telecom kind of world.
Sure.
And so they've always been in it. So coming to it from a completely different perspective, I think I ask things from a perspective of more of a customer than mm-hmm. that, and it's things that they don't think about. And then they bring it to me more, you know, issues from their point of view that I would have never thought of. So it's been very good. It's been very fruitful, these relationships. And it reminds me a lot of oil and gas, because oil and gas, everybody's willing to help you, right?
Absolutely.
Like if you show a curiosity and you show just that you're willing to work hard, mm-hmm. people are there to help you. And this industry is very much the same. There's more than enough business to go around for everybody.
Sure. Sure. I think that's great. And I'd also, you know, similar again, going back to the safety world, I look at how many small businesses are out there that they can't afford a safety professional to be on staff. They can't afford, you know, those types of things, or even business processes, you know,
right.
Like they're not going to have an HR person. They're going to have those things. And I've been fortunate. I've had friends of mine reach out that have these types of businesses. You know, they might have 50 people working for them. And like, can you help me with this or help me with that? And I really do think there's a place for a business like that. And yours is very similar, I think, at least it sounds to me, where you can go in and you can say, here's sort of, you know, business in a box type of thing. This is what your business would really thrive with, these softwares, hardwares, whatever. Similar to like, hey, your business needs this HR to book and these policies and this training platform and whatever. I think you're well positioned to do that. I think that you're going to be able to help a lot of really, really great companies be even more successful.
And you know, enterprise clients are great. The sales cycles are very long, and when they,
right.
you know, when they finally sign, it's great. It's lucrative, and those are great. But
right.
I really do. I mean, 90% of my business, or maybe 80% of the business, is SMBs, and
yep.
it's people who they need the help, and it's like, yep. Like, you don't have to go spend a bunch of money at the size that you're at. Let's do this. But then I'm here to watch you grow, and I'm here to help you grow.
Right.
And let's do it together.
Yeah, and I would think that probably, and this is just me making up a number on the spot, but 80 or 90% of businesses in the world are SMBs, right? I mean, there's so many more of those than there are those enterprise-level clients. So, man, thank you again for taking time to sit with me and you know, again, share your story. And I can't wait to see in a year or two where Bits is. But again, if you want to get out of oil and gas out of your life, rename it.
That's a good point. Yeah,
it was just funny when you said that. I was like, Bits. I wonder how many people see that and think, you know, oil and gas with you, but it's fine.
Yep.
I guess you can leave it that. So anyway, but Richard, thank you again for taking time to meet me up here and share your story.
I appreciate it.
Awesome,
thank
man.
All right.
All right. Take care, bud.
Yep.
Hey, bye.